This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Well, good evening and welcome. This is the 53rd year that Whitworth has hosted the Great Decisions Lecture Series. It's, again, hosted by the Political Science Department, which includes political science, cross-cultural studies, peace studies, and international studies majors. My name is Patrick Van Inwijen. I'm chair of the Political Science Department. But it's as a member of the Asian Studies minor at Whitworth that I'm particularly excited about tonight's lecture. So if you're interested in the Asian Studies minor, please come up and talk to either myself or Professor Clark. Tonight is the final of the Great Decisions Lecture Series, and tonight's is entitled China's Great Unity, U.S.-China Relations on the New Global Horizon. It's a real treat for Whitworth to host tonight's speaker, Dr. Anthony Clark. Even though this is his first year as a professor of East Asian history at Whitworth, he has already had several prominent public engagements, including coordinating an academic symposium on Matteo Ricci, the first Jesuit missionary in China, who established a pattern for Sino-Western relations, and he hosted the foreign minister, or the functional equivalent of the foreign minister of the Tibetan Parliament in exile here at Whitworth. Dr. Clark's research centers on the history of Western conflict and accommodation in China, especially regarding Catholic missionary activities during the Ming and Qing eras, that's 1368 through 1911. He is author of several academic and popular books, including books and articles on Chinese historiography, cultural interaction between China and the West, and his primary interest, the history of Sino-Western religious and cultural representation during China's late imperial and early modern era. It is from this expertise in history, as well as his many travels in China, that we come to tonight's topic. Informed by history, Dr. Clark will help us understand some of the current interactions with the United States. Again, tonight's lecture is entitled China's Great Unity, U.S.-China Relations on the New Global Horizon. Please join me in welcoming Professor Anthony Clark.
I was just sitting out on the park bench with my wife, Amanda, and as we were sitting there were mosquitoes flying around, and I was sort of batting them away. And when I put the microphone on, I just had this overwhelming sense that this was a mosquito. So if I keep hitting the microphone, that's the reason. Let me just pause for 1 second before we start and ask a question. So bear with me for a second. 就是有一个问题，有没有中国人今天来的？有没有中国人？ 只有一二三四四位欢迎欢迎。其实我告诉你们，我的专业是汉朝的历史，不是经济学。所以如果我讲错误的话，你可以来改一改，好不好？不好意思。So that's the I'd like to start with that. That's relevant to what I'm going to talk about tonight. Let me just first start by thanking Professor Van Inwijen. And let me start by acknowledging that Professor Van Inwijen just received tenure at Whitworth University, so congratulations. As we say in academics, he's now wearing the golden handcuffs. So welcome, and that's wonderful. I'd also like to thank the Whitworth Political Science Department and the World Affairs Council for having me here tonight to speak on what I think is an essential topic. In fact, I hate to say this, and I often tell my students this may be the most important class you take, and I think that our discussion about China may be one of the most important things any of us talk about in the world today. And I hope I can sort of argue that point throughout my talk. But I also wanted to start by saying something. That is, when I started as what we call a classical sinologist, oh, really 15, 20 years ago, I remember studying Han Dynasty texts on history, Qing Dynasty texts on history, studying, you know, the books I would receive would have a title like Zhou Dynasty Morphology in Linguistic Theory and, you know, and various poetic pronunciations of characters in the Shijing. Well, China scholars, really for the last 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, we've found ourselves in the corner of the academic room, sort of alone, you know, struggling over Chinese characters, learning to read, write, and speak Chinese, sort of alone. And for the first time, we're all experiencing something very new. That is, everyone else is suddenly looking at our corner. And so we're sort of feeling, oh, well, I've been studying China alone for decades, and suddenly everyone's looking to me. And they're not only looking to me, but they're asking me questions. The number of jobs in academe for a China scholar is growing exponentially right now. When I used to get books about morphology in Chinese writing from the Zhou Dynasty, I wanted to share some of the books that have been coming to my office lately. Oxford University Press, The Changing Face of China from Mao to Market, has nothing to do with the Zhou Dynasty. China's Transformations, The Stories Beyond the Headlines. Here's one of my favorite titles, China Modernizes, Threat to the West or Model for the Rest. And my absolute favorite, China Getting Rich First. This is what's being published right now and being published in huge numbers. So I just wanted to preface my talk tonight by that, just sort of outlining the new landscape of China, the world of China, the way we think about China, the way scholars think about China. And the last thing I want to say, too, is before I really get started, that is, I'm a historian. So for those of us here who are really, really interested in political theory or economics, there'll be some of that. But I promise there will also be a good dose of history in my talk today. And my approach tonight is going to be a bit unfamiliar to Americans, I think. And that is, my goal will be to help all of us here imagine U.S.-China relations a little more from China's perspective. And in my scholarship, I think a lot about what happens when Westerners meet Chinese, both here and in China. And one of the things I like to do is read Chinese books to speak with Chinese people about their impressions. It's something I think that needs to happen more often. Well, let me get started. This is Shanghai today. I'd like to begin with some information that many of us might not be aware of. 10 years ago, China sent an absolute huge number of students to the United States of America to enroll in our colleges. Today, Chinese universities boast three times the number of college students that American universities do. And China today is not sending nearly as many people here. A growing number of Chinese students are opting to stay in China. In fact, at Beijing University last year, students, just to make a statement, were signing an agreement never to study in America. This is a new phenomenon that hasn't ever happened in history. Let me also say another thing. Here's an interesting statistic. In the top 1% of IQ tests, the number of Chinese children who have scored in that top 1%, and that top 1% outnumber all of America's children total. 3% of American college students study Mandarin Chinese. 100% of Chinese college students have studied English. In the next few years, this might stun, this is absolutely a fact. China will be the number one English-speaking country on earth. There will be more fluent speakers of English in China than anywhere else on earth. So these are some things that we should sort of think about. And also, let me just say another thing. This is Seattle, Washington, not too far from us. In the next 5 minutes, about 67 people will be born in the United States of America. And in the next 5 minutes, 274 people will be born in China. This is the Beijing I visited in 1996. Now, this isn't the Forbidden City, mind you. This is a Hutong neighborhood, sort of in the what we now call the University District, in over by Haidian. This is the same district when I was there last year. It's a striking difference. This is the Zhongguancun. This actually is an image of really right next door to what the sort of technology, the cameras, and the sort of technology area. Beijing is now a city of groovy high-rises and hip entrepreneurs in Mercedes, Beamers, and Priuses. When I was first there in 1996, you had to dodge bicycles, and there were, you know, horse-drawn chariots still going through the streets with baicai on them, with vegetables. Well, U.S. economists are watching China's unprecedented economic growth. Our government is only just now beginning to realize, my estimation, that to understand China's current successes, we must begin to view China from China's point of view. And this is something that we have failed at doing, I would argue. This means that we need to revisit history. We need to realize that China has not operated and does not operate as the West has most often assumes it has. And I want to give you a little example. And it has to do with the Cultural Revolution, which in America, you know, when students come to my class, they often want to talk about the Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 1976. And there are some interesting assumptions made about the Cultural Revolution. It's often assumed that the Cultural Revolution was a political movement precipitated by certain Marxist ideals related to revolution. It was an ideological movement, it was a political movement, it was an economic movement. Some people will nod to the idea that perhaps Mao was using the Cultural Revolution as a way to sort of nourish the so-called cult of Mao. But I want to say that all of these things are only partially true. In fact, they're mostly untrue. After Mao's disastrous, and I would argue disastrous policies during the Great Leap Forward, about 1958, 1959 to 1961, more or less, party officials became suspicious of Mao's abilities as an administrator. Sure, there was a cult of Mao. Sure, people were absolutely, when they looked around, they saw statues of Mao. They certainly were reading his sayings that he had given at Yan'an. Certainly there was this appreciation for Mao as a revolutionary, but the administrators were nonetheless extremely suspicious that Mao could basically run China as an administrator. Now, Patrick has given me the opportunity to do something I've always done, wanted to do, never done this before. This is Wu Han, the deputy mayor of Beijing, and I've always wanted to do this. I love Wuhan's glasses. Anyway, I lament the loss of these kind of the so-called Harry Potter glasses. I was first. I should get royalties. But I lament the loss of these kinds of these glasses, these black round glasses, and I lament the sort of what seems to be the sort of dying practice of wearing old-fashioned self-tied bow ties. In any case, this is the deputy mayor of Beijing named Wuhan. He was a historian of the Ming Dynasty. This is an important point. He's the mayor of Beijing during Mao's era. He's an historian of the Ming Dynasty. He's an academic who wrote a traditional Chinese play, an opera, about a virtuous Ming Dynasty minister named Hai Rui, who was dismissed from office because he had submitted a memorial to the Ming emperor complaining about his misbehavior. Well, in this opera, the minister's name is Hai Rui. In this opera, Mao saw something different. What he saw was a circuitous allusion to something that he himself had done. In the opera by Wuhan, that was about this Ming official, Hai Rui, criticizing the emperor, Mao saw it as a criticism of the way he had purged Peng Dehuai after Peng Dehuai had criticized Mao for his actions, for his policies in the Great Leap Forward. So let me just show you a clip from the opera. So let me tell you that I think all scholars that I know of China argue that this opera is probably the number one reason the Cultural Revolution began. It had very little to do with other things and a lot to do with this opera. When this opera was performed, Mao became seriously enraged. He viewed it as a critique of him that was rendered through literature, that was rendered through an opera. As Edwin Moyes, he's a great scholar of modern Chinese history, has said, quote, "The great proletarian cultural revolution began as a campaign to root out bourgeois influences in art and literature," end quote. How often do people today in the West think that the Cultural Revolution had anything to do with art and literature? Well, here's something people often don't know. It was not just a Marxist revolution orchestrated by Mao to nourish his own reputation. China's political landscape is traditionally centered on the value of art and literature. So if you look at these images, you see Chairman Mao in the upper left and Deng Xiaoping in the lower right. They're writing calligraphy. Chairman Mao is very well known for his poetry. Classically, until 1905, the way you became an official in government was that you passed a very rigorous exam in Confucian philosophy, in calligraphy, and in poetry. That is, your character was revealed in how well you wrote a poem. If you were to become a leader, an official in China, you had to be a good poet, a good calligrapher. I don't know of any historical moment in the West, in our society, wherein that was the requisite way to get into politics. Well, so it's true that a poem or a traditional opera can precipitate in China a cultural revolution. It's absolutely a fact. But we're not here to talk about poetry. We're here to talk about China's economy, to talk about the modern context of China and the United States. So let's look at China's recent economic and political rise and see if we can better understand its policies. And here's where history begins. For most scholars, modern China is divided into two periods. It is the pre-Deng Xiaoping era and the post-Deng Xiaoping era. This is the so-called beginning of China's, what we usually say as China's economic explosion. So I should note that, and this is part of my argument today, that during the Cultural Revolution and slightly before, right, during the Maoist era, one of the most popular songs in China was a song called in Chinese, "Meiyou Gongchang Dangzhou, Meiyou Xin Zhongguo," which simply means, without communism, there is no new China. And I think that's really an important point. That is, that at that era, during the Maoist period, no communism, no new China. I think it's an important question for us to ask, what is this new China that Mao was talking about, and what is the new China that was envisioned by Deng Xiaoping after 1979, 1980, 1981? So the question is, has communism ushered in a new China? This is a poster that was popular during the Great Leap Forward period and still shown quite a bit during the Cultural Revolution, during the Maoist era, of the so-called New China. That is this sort of agrarian utopia, an agricultural and economic utopia where everyone would have everything that he or she would wish to eat, that no one would go hungry. For Mao, this was an ideological victory of the new communist China over the old feudal past. And I think this is an extremely important point. During the Cultural Revolution, this poster was quite popular. And it says, smash to smithereens, destroy the old world, and build a new one. And if you look carefully, you see the Hongwei Bing, the Red Guard, is smashing some interesting objects. On the right, you have a book with the Confucian virtue, or Taoist, I guess, of virtue. You have a record, you have some dice, a Buddha, you have a crucifix representing Western religion. This is not a feudal rolling pin. This is actually a Chinese scroll that is rolled up. So basically the notion is, right, to create a new China, you have to destroy the old one. That's the sort of definition of this idea of this new China. Well, after Deng Xiaoping, something very different has happened. A very different kind of art appeared, right? The Maoist era, the new China of the Maoist era, had decidedly changed from a vision of an ideological utopia to a materialist utopia, a utopia of commodification. Even the revolutionary art, the so-called Geming Yishu, the revolutionary art of the Maoist era, became a commodity to be sold. So today's Beijing, the 798 Art District, which is where a lot of this art is produced, right? It boasts a thriving art-selling culture which derives its profits from the commodification of old images of the new China. So those things that were sort of sacred in the past are now to be sold, to be re-represented. It's now okay to poke fun at these revolutionary images that were produced during the Maoist era. So how do we get from this new China of the Cultural Revolution to Deng Xiaoping's new China of making money? This is a very large question that people ask today. The one thing I want to say, too, is that today's so-called new China, right, from the Western point of view, Western scholars have largely argued that in China, modernization equals Westernization. That is, as China has modernized, we've seen Western-style buildings, you see Western-style clothing, you see Western-style hairstyles, although I can't boast of any certain kind of hairstyle. But there has been this notion that you get that Westernization is modernization in China. So some scholars today, or some politicians today, or economic advisors like to say that, well, now we live in an era where it's an era of the West meeting the West. That when we deal with China, it's really Westerners dealing with Westerners. And the big question is that really true? Is that true? Is it now an era where Westerners deal in their negotiations? Is it Western negotiation with another Western country? It's a very large question. Well, I would argue that Deng Xiaoping's new China is actually not nearly as Western as is assumed. It's very much more nuanced than that. So this is Deng Xiaoping on the left and Chairman Mao on the right. So we need to ask a question. Is communism really necessary for Deng Xiaoping's new economic and political policies? So let me start with two Deng Xiaoping quotes that I shudder to say you would never hear uttered during the Maoist era. And for those of us who have studied Marxist theory, we might find a bit of a problem in these new quotes. First, he said, poverty is not socialism. Well, that's fine. But then the second thing he said was, to get rich is glorious. The curious thing about that quote is the only part of that quote that exists really popularly in China and here is the second part. To get rich is glorious. He also said that reform is China's second revolution. That it's not about a revolution, so to speak, in the Marxist context, but now it's really about reform. So Deng Xiaoping, and I think it's important to note, Deng Xiaoping, and here's where history comes into play, Deng Xiaoping became China's ruler in the wake of several very traumatic events. First, he witnessed some massive transformations in Chinese society. The May 4th movement, 1919, the Hundred Flowers movement in 1956 to 1957, the Great Leap Forward, 1958, 1959, some place it to 1960. And part of that was the Great Sparrow Campaign. This is Mao's policy. This is why Mao had lost the support of his fellow colleagues, his fellow comrades in the party. For example, he thought that since sparrows ate seeds, perhaps we should get rid of sparrows and we would have better crops. So people went out and during the Great Leap Forward and beat on pots. Sparrows literally did. They actually scientifically calculated how long it would take a sparrow to get exhausted from flight, fall out of the sky, and then they would harvest the sparrows. So there was a kind of a massive extermination of sparrows during the Great Sparrow Campaign through the Great Leap Forward. But what Mao didn't know is that sparrows ate locusts that ate crops. So after the Great Sparrow Campaign, there was an enormous loss of crops due to locusts that weren't eaten by the sparrows, which would have been their natural predators. So this sort of lack of understanding of agrarian cycles led people to think Mao perhaps wasn't such a great administrator. But Deng Xiaoping, in the wake of these events, was not an ideologue. He was a pragmatist, and that's very important. At 15 years old, he had gone to France to study Marxism. One thing that Deng Xiaoping says that I absolutely have to disagree with, he said that Paris was a boring city. I've lived there twice, and that's the most absurd thing Deng Xiaoping ever said. But while he was in Paris, he actually studied Marxism from Zhou Enlai, among others. So he was a supporter of Mao, and after the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, Mao appointed Deng Xiaoping Secretary General of the Communist Party. But he was purged several times, very much like Peng Dehuai. He was purged several times by Mao during Mao's life. But after Mao died, Deng Xiaoping rose again in power, and in 1981 he became the party chief. And he remained the most powerful person in China easily until his death in 1997. So one of the large issues that occupied Deng Xiaoping in his sort of in his ideas of reform was, how do I deal with Chairman Mao? How do I define him? Certainly, we can't highlight the Greatly Forward. We can't highlight the Great Sparrow Campaign. We have to put Mao in some sort of light that helps him to retain his heroic image as really a sort of like second Guofu, almost like Sun Yat-sen, who was the father of the country. Chairman Mao was, in a sense, the second father of the country. So in a 1982 document by the Central Committee of the Communist Party, I love these long titles by the party. It's on the various historical issues since the founding of the People's Republic of China. That's the name of the document. Deng Xiaoping says, quote, Mao was a great Marxist, proletarian, revolutionary, militarist, and great general. And then when confronted, how do we deal with Mao during the Great Leap Forward? Deng Xiaoping simply said, Mao was, quote, seven parts good and three parts bad. When asked which parts were good and which parts were bad, he remained silent. So Mao was able to retain his sort of position as an icon, yet at the same time there was an admission that he had made some mistakes. Interestingly enough, the mistakes that Mao made were officially blamed not on him, but on the Gang of Four. Actually, in China, when you ask people about the Gang of Four, they say the Gang of Four. And well, we won't tell you who this one is. But anyway, Deng Xiaoping was determined to open up China to the world, to develop its economy. And here's where I go back to this American notion that now we deal with China as Westerners negotiating with Westerners, right? Deng Xiaoping determined to open up China to the world and develop its economy through a Chinese version of well, almost like capitalism, a Chinese version of economic change, simply called the Gaige Kaifang, economic reform. And what are Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms? He called it socialism with Chinese characteristics. And that's the important sort of the second tag to that is very important. It's socialism with Chinese characteristics. From people in America who are Marxist theorists, they call it capitalism in disguise, or Chinese materialism in a socialist costume. So certainly his economic theories, from very orthodox Marxist point of view, don't make any sense. But nonetheless, he can say, and the Chinese is very interesting, it says, 具有中国特色的社会主义. Literally, it's completely socialism with China's characteristics, with pieces of Chinese-ness attached to them. Well, Deng's reforms claimed to be Marxist, but on Chinese terms. It was transformed into Chinese Marxism. This isn't new. I think Mao's version of Marxism was also very Chinese, especially in defining who the proletariat were. Proletariat, from Mao's point of view, weren't those in the factories and the cities. That's not where all the workers were. The workers in China were peasants. So the proletariat had to change. The working model of Marxist thought had to be adjusted from Mao's point of view to make it work in China. But nonetheless, Westerners, Western theorists, have struggled to define what China's political system is. Like, what is it? And from China's point of view, when you read the documents, they simply call it, well, socialism with Chinese characteristics. It has to fit China. So, in a sense, we're really not Westerners dealing with Westerners. We're Westerners dealing with Western ideas, but with Chinese characteristics. And that is my first point about how Sino-American relations need to begin. That is, we need to sort of rethink how we envision Marxism, rethink how we envision capitalism. Because from China's point of view, it's nuanced very differently. We need to sort of step into their ideological view, their political theoretical view, and sort of look at it from that standpoint. So one last bit of history for those of us who haven't taken my class, and most of us should. We should all take my class on Chinese history. I should be a Whitworth student. Deng's economic reforms are often summed up in what has been called the Shige Xian Dai Hua, the four modernizations. And interestingly, the four modernizations were thought up not by Deng Xiaoping, they were thought up by Zhou Enlai. So this is Zhou Enlai, and with the four modernizations, clearly we'll have a country of happy children. I love these propaganda posters. And there's a whole new industry, by the way, as China becomes more popular. There's an industry of coffee table books about China. You can get coffee table books about tea and the Great Wall and the Forbidden City, and you can get coffee table books really about propaganda posters, and those are really some of my favorite ones. In any case, Deng Xiaoping's goal was to build a modern industrial economy through a Chinese, quote, socialist market economy, end quote. China was to become an economic contender. Listen carefully. Early 80s, Deng Xiaoping said, with these four modernizations and how we'll structure them, with his economic reforms, China was to be an economic contender with the United States by the early to mid 21st century. Now, what's significant about that is I just was reading an essay by Professor Baum at UCLA, who absolutely says, and Ezra Vogel, who's at Harvard, who both argued that China economically is passing us right now. In fact, the word I keep hearing is that we've had the last century, maybe two centuries, but this century is China's century. You know, I actually said that once at a lecture I gave in Canada. And afterward, you know, it's so funny, I kept saying over and over again, China is not trying to take over the world. It's not. This isn't an era of yellow peril. Like, that's an absurd notion. But I still had a student that came up to me after my lecture and said, Professor Clark, I'm really scared. I said, why? He says, is China going to take over the world? I just said no several times. But there's still a kind of anxiety about that. And interestingly enough, I mean, the demographics of our world are changing. There's no doubt about it. In fact, if we all were to take off right now the clothing that we're wearing that was produced in China, it would be a really interesting game of strip poker right now. And we would all be sort of, we would be in trouble. Our shoes, our umbrellas, and China makes more umbrellas. Most umbrellas come from China. Coming from Oregon, I use a lot of Chinese products. So in any case, here we are in the 21st century, and economists now admit that Deng's policies have worked. I love these images. Deng Xiaoping traveled abroad and was one of the first Chinese leaders to visit the United States. In fact, he was the first Chinese leader to visit the United States in 1979. And he visited the United States in 1979 right after President Carter had discontinued formal diplomatic ties with Taiwan, which is, we could say, a province, and established diplomatic relations formally with the People's Republic of China. As soon as President Carter did that, Deng Xiaoping rushed to America where, and I forgot who's the singer who sings Rocky Mountain High? I've forgotten. What is his name? John Denver. Well, John Denver had a very emotive, did a very emotive performance for Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping went to a rodeo and then he He was in the simulate. He wore a cowboy hat. It was great. And he was in the simulated rocket at NASA. It's great. But what really strikes me about this image, interestingly, is I've lived in China a lot in my life. And, you know, in China, you smile when you're embarrassed. And it's so funny because I've been with my dear Chinese friends. They'll say, okay, we're going to be with Americans. Smile a lot because Americans like to smile. And it's sort of interesting because as I see Deng Xiaoping here smiling with Jimmy Carter, it's very ambiguous as to why he's smiling. But in any case, Deng Xiaoping really was wise, knowing that if we're going to do business with these other cultures, these other countries, we need to be their friends. Chinese students started really in earnest studying English and America in 1979. We've still not begun. And I'll make an argument about that in just a minute. Well, so first off, Deng Xiaoping really marks the beginning, I think, the very beginning of our serious Sino-American ties. Sino-American relations really began now, in many ways. But since I'm a historian, and we've been talking about modern Chinese for a while, I'd like to go back to the Qing Dynasty. And maybe I can explain to you why everything that's going on in China right now, and I mean everything, has a lot to do with Kang Youwei. Now, for those of you who are read Chinese, we'll be talking a lot about a book called The Great Unity, or Da Tong. And the Chinese for that, this is important, is Da Tong, right? Da Tong. Now, this saying is very common in China today, and it's very influential in China's political system, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. Well, Da Tong means great unity. And it's really a radical political philosophy that was formulated in the late Qing Dynasty by this intellectual named Kang Youwei, who is I've read his work in Chinese. He's absolutely brilliant. But he wrote a book called Da Tong Shu, The Book of Great Unity. As an exercise, if you're interested in reading the strangest book, one of the strangest books you'll ever read, order it on interlibrary loan or something. Get the Great Unity book by Kang Youwei and read it. It's a fascinating read. Well, in any case, China's political jargon today is riddled with this term, Great Unity. It's also used as the name for Chinese travel agencies. It's used in political parlance and economic parlance. It's used as the name of industrial companies, and it's used as the name for internet news sites. So the word Great Unity, Da Tong, is very common in the Chinese language today. Like the Cultural Revolution's connection to traditional opera that I mentioned earlier, which was in turn connected to Ming Dynasty imperial politics, China's modern political worldviews now are largely enmeshed in the late Qing idea of Da Tong, of Great Unity. So let me outline Kang Youwei's ideas, and perhaps they can illustrate how they remain influential in China today. So bear in mind, first, that when we as Americans imagine our own history, we place our own history, but how old is our country? About 200 years. When China imagines its history classically, it imagines its history as being 5,000 years old. So when Kang Youwei began writing his text, one of his intellectual positions was, well, we are the world's big brother. We're the oldest extant culture that's still basically connected to its past in the present world. So his political reforms view China as an ancient civilization vis-a-vis a world of new ones. That's the first important point about his intellectual position. And the principal elements of Kang Youwei's Great Unity Theory reflects China's cultural disdain. Now, I'm going to read to you a few passages and give you a bit of an explanation of this, that actually, for those of us who are China scholars or who think about China's economic materialism today, it might be a little shocking about what I'm going to say, but it actually makes sense if you think about the whole picture. Kang Youwei's theory basically argues that in this great unity that he's looking for, we should, in a sense, always bear in mind China's traditional cultural disdain for selfish interests over public good. That is, basically, the Chinese language has traditionally no word for love, by the way. There's no classical word in Chinese for love. The word I, if you study etymologically, what is translated as love meant something like debt. So I love you in Chinese before really it encountered the West meant something like I debt you, or you debt me. But there's also no word for private. That word doesn't exist. The closest word is the character si, which always meant selfish. So the Western idea of private enterprise, which is translated as 私人企业, would traditionally mean something like selfish business enterprise, if you translate it perfectly. So maybe the word 私 today is less pejorative than it used to be, but certainly that connotation holds over a little bit. So Kang Youwei wrote that one of the principal causes of world conflict, now hang in there, one of the principal causes of world conflict is the existence of national boundaries and patriotism. And this is interesting because in no way can we argue that China isn't extremely patriotic today. When you visit kindergartens or schools, they'll say, well, we love our motherland. There's a kind of this idea of patriotism, Aiguo, is very important today in China. But nonetheless, he argues that national boundaries and patriotism are the causes of conflict in the world today. So elevating private interests are the cause of problem. This idea is rooted in Kang's interpretation of Confucianism, which has through all of China's history villainized the very concept of personal profit. This was a dirty word in ancient China, and it's not today. Li, profit, that's an evil thing, classically. If you look at Chinese social system, it's the spam system. Scholars, peasants, artisans, and merchants. People who were after profit, Li, were at the bottom of China's social system. So traditionally, from the Zhou Dynasty until the Qing Dynasty, being a merchant, being a business person, was the lowest possible social level you could have. It's more complicated than that, but basically that's the Confucian worldview. Let me give you a couple quotes from the Da Tong Shu. Quote, those who advocate the theory of competition understand nature, but do not understand man. There is no way to correct them. This is typical Kang Youwei. Their stupidity is enormous. If we do not free the way of man from the selfishness of having the family and private enterprise, and yet we desire to do away with competition, how can it be done? End quote. And to the great pleasure of the post-1949 government, Kang Youwei also wrote this, quote, for enabling the farmers to obtain equality of subsistence, we may perhaps advocate the methods of communism. End quote. So he didn't ascribe to communism holistically, but certainly he thought that communism was one way to envision this new great unity that he was arguing for. Kang Youwei's great unity theory argued that along with the problems caused by private enterprise and national boundaries, right, that the notion of national identity was a great cause of corruption, right? So in the second part of his book, he writes this, quote, from individual people were formed family clans. Accumulating family clans coalesced to form tribes. Accumulating tribes coalesced to form nations. Accumulating nations coalesced to form large states. Always this coalescing to become larger was accomplished by numberless wars and attained by unlimited grinding down of the people. End quote. As Kang Youwei sees it, the formation of nation states results in the emergence of patriotism. That's important. Quote, states having been established, patriotisms are born. Everyone looks to the advantage of his own state and aggresses against other states, end quote. So he also says that patriotism, quote, poisons the human race, end quote. So for Kang Youwei, the very idea that we're patriotic, that we have borders, poisons us. It makes us think in terms of we and they, and it makes us enter into competition and removes the possibility of a unified world. And that's sort of Kanye West's vision. And let me also make the point. The Chinese government today doesn't completely ascribe to everything Kanye West writes, but there are certain aspects of it that have remained very strong in the currency of intellectual discussion today. Well, the answer to these divisions, according to Kanye West, is to create a new world without borders, in an abstract sense perhaps, called the Great Unity. Now, so I'm not suggesting that China wants this Great Unity to be completely a Chinese world. Not completely, right? But I want to talk to you about Kanye West's point of view, because that's very interesting. For example, Kanye West argued that in the world there should be what he calls a universal parliament. That is, there needs to be a parliament that is universal, that all peoples can have a representative represent them to engage in political debate, in certain decision-making policies. And his argument was, well, that if you're going to have a universal parliament, you need to have a standardized language. We need to have a Great Unity language wherein basically there are no more divisions, linguistic divisions. We need to find the best possible language for all people to speak. And, well, if you can guess what Kanye West's answer was, Chinese. It's the best language. It's the oldest language. He argued that it's the most sensible language. And by the way, this is his handwriting, which is very good if you study Chinese calligraphy. So from his point of view, this new world, and as you read his text, looks suspiciously Chinese. Culturally, linguistically, intellectually, it looks suspiciously Chinese. And I think the important thing to argue is that Kanye West, in his vision of this Great Unity, was Chinese. Now, interestingly, and this is a kind of a stupid, absurd statement, but Americans are in the end Americans, and Chinese are, after all, Chinese. We very much see the world in our own sort of, in our own context, in our own worldview. So often I've taken students to China, and you know, after their second or third day, they'll confront me and say, "Professor Clark, wow, where am I? Where am I right now? Like my whole world is I don't know where I am." And it's interesting. Actually, my Chinese friends have said that to me too. I had a Chinese friend who wanted to move to America, and he moved to America, and his dream was to marry an American wife. So he went to the University of Oregon. He's like so excited. He got off the plane. We went shopping. I don't know why, but he bought about how many tubes of toothpaste? Like 5 tubes of toothpaste because he was paranoid he wouldn't get back to the shop. And within 3 weeks or 4 weeks, I said, "So how's it going with the girlfriend thing?" And he said, "文化沟通太大了." Like the cultural divide is huge. He's like, "I'm not interested in American girls anymore." Well, it's interesting how when we encounter each other and are in this other culture, we tend to our views tend to shift. Well, in any case, Great Unity is absolutely part of modern Chinese parlance today, and I think we need to remember that. To connect, and I'm just about finished, to connect Kanye West, not just to travel agencies, not to factories, not just to internet news sites named Great Unity, named .home, right? To connect Kanye West in a more realistic sense to China of today, we really have no further to go than to the Olympics. If you think about Kanye West's influence intellectually, if you think about Deng Xiaoping's connection to the Chinese past and calligraphy and Mao Zedong's writing poetry and appreciating Chinese art, Chairman Mao slept with a pile of classics on his bed. When the Red Guards were destroying ancient histories, Chairman Mao was reading Han Feizi, who was the sort of the intellectual thinker of legalism. Chairman Mao's hero was the first emperor of China, Qin Shi Huangdi. Not because he was bad, but because he unified China. Because Qin Shi Huangdi made a Da Tong, Tian Xia Yi. The empire is one. So in a sense, we can't separate anything in China, anything from its distant past. The motto at the Olympics, 同一个世界, 同一个梦想. Well, how do we translate that? In English, it's translated as one world, one dream. That's wrong. I think that's a bad translation. I would translate it a unified world and a unified dream. Very much connected, I think, and actually I don't think, I know, to a lot of the intellectual currents that were being born when Kanye Wei was offering his thoughts at the end of the 19th century. Well, let me just end with a few more points about present China to tie all of this together. My larger suggestion has been that China's relationship with the United States cannot hope to be smooth until America makes an attempt to understand China from China's point of view. They have been trying to understand us since 1979. This includes, firstly, making the Chinese language a priority in our educational system. Several countries, and this is, fascinates me, in Europe, Canada even, have thought about making Mandarin Chinese mandatory to graduate from high school. I don't think we've talked about it at all here. Secondly, we need to understand that China does not view its present state as disconnected from its historical past. To be Chinese is to be part of a 5,000-year history. When I'm walking through the Forbidden City, I walk through doors, and I often think this door is older than my country. It's fascinating to me. Chairman Mao and Deng Xiaoping cannot be separated from Kanye Wei. Even more, they cannot be separated from Confucius, from Mencius, from Xunzi, from Zhuxi, from Zhuangzi, from Laozi, from Han Feizi, from Qin Shi Huangdi, from all the figures that have made Zhongguo, Zhongguo, China, China. Confucius is making a historical resurrection in China. Mao appreciated legalism from Han Feizi way back in the Zhou dynasty as an important thinker. Deng's economic policies were influenced by Confucius and Kanye Wei, socialism with Chinese characteristics. Let me close with a bit of data. I want to just end with some thoughts that were rendered by Professor Lionel Jensen in a recent essay on the United States and its relationships with China on the global horizon. In a joint communique, this is me, by the way, just looking. This is not Lionel Jensen, the next quote, something I looked up. In a joint communique of the United States and China in 1972, listen carefully. In this joint communique of the United States and China in 1972, the American government stated that, quote, China will never be a superpower, end quote. Our government was wrong. Absolutely wrong. China's purchasing power is now second to the United States. The purchasing power of China is higher than Japan. Every book here notes that. I don't know. I'm not an economist. But China actually consumes more than any other country. Since 2002, the United States' national security strategy has become increasingly vocal in its fear that the, quote, these are their words, rise of China can only mean security difficulties for America, end quote. America now fears China's military to an extent that the United States is underwriting the production at the cost of many, many millions of dollars of long-range missiles aimed towards China. I think that this is a sadly aggressive stance to take, especially since China spends very little compared to us in terms of its defense budget. America spends more than all the G8 countries combined. Feeding China's massive energy consumption to propel its economy is perhaps more pressing than China's military strength. I'm going to say, in my argument, I often think if when I retire, I hope I can retire in China. I love living in China. I never understand the kind of paranoia that Americans have about the rise of China. There are some interesting things before I end, and I'll end in about 5 minutes. It's interesting, too, that recently our real estate costs have gone down so low from Chinese point of view that it's become a popular form of, like, U.S. Tourist tour for Chinese wealthy urbanites to basically fly to the United States and buy cheap neighborhoods, not just houses, cheap neighborhoods to rent to Americans as our economy improves. So from my point of view, that's fascinating. My students, when I told them that, they're a little freaked out. From my point of view, learn Chinese because it's always nice to know your landlords. So in one sense, things are definitely changing, but I absolutely think that the yellow peril paradigm is the wrong way to think. But China has a massive economy and an issue of propelling this economy and keeping its energy consumption flowing is it's much more pressing than its military strength. So let me just say this: most of China's population is very poor. I like to think of it this way. In just a few weeks, month and a half, I'll be in Shanghai, and I don't know of any American cities that are more impressive than Shanghai. There are parts of Beijing that I don't know of any American city that are as impressive. So in my mind, when I go to China today, I think, well, the Chinese cities blow ours away. But when I also go to the countryside, the poverty blows our poverty away. So there's almost like Liang Zhongguo, two Chinas. And to sort of render a praise for China's government today, it's working very hard to improve the living situation of the peasants. China isn't ignoring the poor. It's very much concerned about improving their lives. Well, a multitude of books are being published today discussing how China is presently spending billions to sustain America's deeply indebted economy. As Lionel Jensen wrote in his essay, quote, "China is a nation of contradictions, every bit as confounding as those of the United States. But it is clearly on an upward global political trajectory, while the United States, still prominent, is in decline." End quote. I wonder if the future of U.S.-China relations is one of conflict or confluence. I suggest that the beginning of U.S.-China relations needs to be an American recognition that improved relations can only be achieved by a better U.S. understanding of China. That is, the China of Confucius, the China of the Ming Dynasty, the China of Kanye Wei, in short, the China of 5,000 years of history. China is not just a business opportunity. Let me repeat that. China is not just a business opportunity, and it is not a world threat. It's so interesting to me, people will say, how do I go and make money in China? And I always want to say, why don't you go and make friends in China? As a humanist, that's my position. It's a very old civilization that is best understood in its own language. So I desperately hope that Whitworth's China classes are overflowing in the fall. UCLA last year had 300 students who applied for first-year Chinese who had to be turned away because they couldn't accommodate them. So there is a serious need now for Chinese. Around 1885, Kang Youwei wrote in his Great Unity book, quote, "In the one world of great unity, transportation, communication, and settlement of population will open up the whole earth," end quote. Kang Youwei didn't know the word globalization, but he defined it perfectly. Now, in 2010, this is a reality. The U.S. needs, I believe, more people to study China. As Lionel Jensen ends his essay, quote, "There is much to be done and frighteningly little time," end quote. So today is Earth Day, and I just wanted to let you know something that maybe some of you do know, that is that on a bad note, China is the number one emitter of CO2 in our atmosphere. Chinese cities are smog-laden. Before the Olympics, it was a problem that about 1,000 new cars entered the streets of Beijing per day. That was a problem. People had to see where to go on the tracks. So people who study carbon emissions and smog have actually verified that the Western United States is basically sharing China's smog. Well, in a very real way, everyone in this room right now is smelling China. Right now, we are breathing China. So I just would like to end with this, adds a whole new dimension to the old phrase, wake up and smell the China. Anyway, thank you.
As promised, if you've got questions, if you could raise your hand and I'll come around and use the microphone so everyone can hear the question.
My question is, do you see kind of a mirror imaging where we kind of see China as a threat and they kind of, I guess, return the favor, or do you not see that as the case?
That's a really terrific question. There was a newspaper reporter who came to the United States recently, and someone sort of asked that question: Is America a threat to China right now? And his response was very telling. He said, "Well, America's reputation on the global front has been going down so much lately that for the first time in the last several decades, everyone's looking to us and thinking, 'Wow, China's great.'" So, in a sense, what he was saying is that China's benefiting from some of the global critiques that are happening toward us. So in one sense, I don't think, from my experience in China, I haven't met anyone who felt the United States was a threat to China. I will say this, though. The Chinese word for America is Shijie Jingcha, which means the world police. So they certainly have a kind of pejorative sort of impression of us as being the world's police, you know, that if something happens, we send our troops there to sort of deal with it. But actually, Iraq is being underwritten largely by China. That's just an economic fact. But I absolutely don't think that China considers us a threat at all. Not at all. No.
我非常高兴今天能来到听你演讲，我感觉你演讲的非常好。你的老外会讲国语的。我感觉你说的非常有道理，和我希望能有更多的外国人能这么深的理解中国，和这么开放的去看，这样我们的关系会越来越好。但是我有一个问题要用那个英文问你。Okay,
should I translate that? He said he's all he's happy that you're all here, basically excited about China. Anyway.
Since I've been back in the United States, I lived 7 years in China. I've been back about a year and a half now. And living here, and I read typically around 10 newspapers to 20 newspapers a day. And I do read a lot of fear-mongering coming from the United States. And it almost looks like some of the fear-mongering that came during the late 80s when Japan's economy was growing so strong. But, of course, China's much bigger, and the ideology is different from ours. And with that fear-mongering, on top of it, we also support a lot of the people that are in exile from China, who China sees as a threat. One way we do it is through the National Endowment for Democracy, mm-hmm. which supports the Tibetan government in exile. Mm-hmm. We also support the leader of the Falun Gong. We also support Taiwan's weapons.
You're talking about the United States.
Correct. Yes, I'm talking about the United States here. So on one hand, you know, we the media sometimes tells the people in the United States that you should be afraid of China because they're growing. And on the other hand, we tell the Chinese we want to be friends with you, but we're going to fund and help all the people that dislike and speak out against China. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was reading from Robert Fogel, who is an economist, talking about China in 30 years will be 40% of the GDP in the world, mm-hmm. it seemed like that would be an important friend to have. And I'm more worried that China's, through these actions, while the Chinese eye is on the cookie jar and it wants to get rich, but once it gets rich, once it's first, when it's the biggest, if some of those things are going to come to bite us in the back, even though they don't say it now and even though they say there's friendship, I think the United States needs to start looking at it and saying, well, long term, do we want to be friends with Taiwan? How big's Taiwan? How big's China? Do we want to support 300,000 people, the Tibetans in exile, or do we want to stand behind the 1.3 billion people of China? I see that as one of the major problems, and am I wrong in saying that some of those things might need to be changed?
I don't discern a question of what you're saying. I think mostly what my response is, I agree. That's primarily my response. But I do think, just to sort of push back just a little bit, I think that America isn't entirely wrong with some of its criticisms. But I think that those criticisms are used as a political leverage in our country to sort of kind of like rally us, in a sense, together to kind of deal with what we... I mean, if you basically say China is a threat, then Americans somehow we sort of coalesce together, right? And that sort of empowers us to work harder. I think China is the same thing with, for example, with Japan. Whenever there's a, you know, it happens very frequently. That is, whenever there's a kind of fracturing in China, it seems convenient that the Nanjing massacre will be conjured historically, and oh, China gets back together, oh, that bad Japan. So, and Japan's behavior was deplorable, and I think it should apologize. But I think that as countries, China does the same thing that we do, and I agree with you. It's complicated. We tend to valorize things. Like, I see Free Tibet bumper stickers. I just got back from Tibet. Well, they're more Han Chinese than there are Tibetans. So let's think about this for a second. Should we free North America and give it back to the Native Americans? It's a little late. So I think we need to rethink how we envision Tibet, how we envision global politics, how we envision how we support people. And that's really my point. That is, if we think about things from China's point of view, I think that we will, all of us, have a more nuanced and a more savvy perspective. It's very fascinating to me because sometimes my students will go to China on the plane or in a bus. They're saying all the stuff about China. At the end of the trip, I was wrong about everything. And that's what we need. We need to realize where we were right and where we were wrong and actually be together. So that's sort of my answer to that. Yeah, thank you for learning Chinese, by the way. Copy him.
You said that the U.S. really hasn't taken many steps to, especially like in the schooling system and everything, to try to learn about China in the past. Is that changing at all, or is it still? Because, I mean, is it still very, is there no emphasis, or yeah. Is that changing at all?
So, well, yes, it's getting better. Well, Whitworth hired me, so here I am. So thank you, Whitworth. Eugene, Oregon just opened a Chinese school, so there's an immersion French school. I don't think France is our economic rival, so it makes sense that now, at least in Oregon, you have a Chinese school, so American students go half their day is in Chinese and half their day is in English. So this is happening more and more, and we have the Confucius Institute, which is really being organized by China, but American universities more than ever are establishing satellite campuses in China to basically prepare their students for China. I took 21 students to China last fall. I think two couples might be getting married. That's different. That's not related to what I want to say. But what one student that I've taught is at Duke studying Chinese history. Another student went to the University of Washington to study lit. One student just applied for the CIA to work with the ECIA vis-a-vis China. One student's on a Fulbright in China. So what I'm saying is I think there is a rising awareness of China, and we can't help it. But nonetheless, still right now, 3% of American college students study Chinese, and I think that's actually wrong. So it's getting better.
Hello. My question is two-part. First part is, you mentioned some of the great historical characters and people throughout Chinese history and how they flow back all the way to Kang Youwei and Yue and the others. But also the the Chinese, in Chinese history, they've had such a an influence on, for example, the spread of Buddhism throughout Korea and China, Tian Tai and some of these other folks. So the first question is, how do the modern Chinese kind of choose to connect with some of those past historic figures, but say maybe not with the religious historic figures that, have had such an effect on, the world? And the second part of the question is, you talked about communism and capitalism, socialism. How did the Chinese see us and, as a Christian dominated nation?
Okay, so there are two parts to that question. One is how are Chinese today responding to their religio-cultural heritage, and then second, how do they view China? I mean, how do they view America as this so-called Christian nation, predominantly? Well, that's complicated. It's very complicated because China is not traditionally a Christian country. There's a saying in China. I'm going to answer the second one first and then go back to the first one. There's a saying in China that Buddhism came to China on the back of an elephant, but Christianity came to China on the barrel of a gun. And it's interesting that that's phrased that way because missionaries didn't want to go to China with the sailors in their gunboats. That was one of the unknowns. That is, missionaries who were going to China absolutely thought that these bullying like England and opium thought that was evil. So the Christian missionaries absolutely disdained that. So there was a misconception, I think, on China's part about missionaries coming as a kind of force. But that doesn't mean that Christians didn't also misbehave. So China has a very complicated view of Christianity because of its the opium wars, because of certain historical factors. I mean, if you think about one of the bloodiest rebellions in China's history in the Qing Dynasty was founded by a Hakka man who read a Protestant tract, failed the civil service exam, had a fever in his sort of dismay over having failed, had a dream that God the Father with a long gold beard appeared to him in his dream and said, "You're the younger brother of Jesus, go out and get rid of demons." And he basically decided that he was the younger brother. It's the Taiping Tianguo, the Taiping Rebellion. This is a Chinese person rising up and basically fomenting this violent rebellion, claiming to be the younger brother of Jesus. So from the Chinese official point of view, that's pretty confusing. So, but let me also add to that this. It's not that terrible because Christianity is the fastest growing religion in China today. Absolutely, hands down. For good, I would say for good. When I went in 1996, I never saw a church opened and I never saw anybody wearing a cross or a Bible. Last fall, there were Bible studies in Starbucks and McDonald's. So it's amazing how that's where the Bible studies are, Starbucks and McDonald's. But there they were, and it was open. So I think that there's a much more relaxed view of Christianity right now. So that's that. The first question is, well, Confucius is becoming kind of a hero now. And there is, you know, in the past, there was this idea. There's a Chinese idea called Ti Yong, that is, when the West first encountered China, Chinese intellectuals said, well, why are we losing this opium war? Why are we weaker than Western nations? And their answer was, well, we're Chinese, so in essence, we're, well, in their words, superior to the West. But somehow in use, we're not. So there was the idea that we'll borrow their science and we'll be better at it as Chinese in the end. So the notion at that moment has sort of dissipated. Right? There isn't an identity crisis about being inferior to Westerners or superior to Westerners. China's not thinking that way anymore. The way China's thinking today about its culture is, well, it's great now to be Chinese. Our economy is strong. Our people are more optimistic than they've been in recent memory. So it's okay to like Confucius. You can go to the bookstore now. You can find the Analects of Confucius or the Mencius or all the classics. So, and Buddhist temples are reopening and Taoism is flourishing. Actually, Buddhism is flourishing just below Christianity in China today. So there really is a reclaiming of China's sort of cultural identity. But that said, let me render one critique of China today. And that is the critique I think that most Christians have about China. When I ride in taxi cabs, I like to ask a question. 你信什么? 你信教吗? What do you believe in? And the answer I get almost all the time is 我信我，我信钱. I believe in myself and I believe in money. That's actually not anything to laugh at, I think. That's a serious tragedy. When I'm visiting Christians in China, when I ask them, what is the biggest crisis in China today? They'll say, we're the wealthiest we've been in a long time. And we're having a crisis of soul, a crisis of spirit, a crisis of morality. So, when Mother Teresa came to the United States, she had these water bottles in front of her. They were like Evian or something. And she said, why? You know how many people I could feed with what you just spent to give me this water bottle? She said that America might be the wealthiest country, but it's spiritually the poorest. I think China is catching up to us. So that's my opinion on that front. That's my criticism. I think the optimism in China is wonderful. I've never seen China so optimistic as it is now. In fact, when I look at my students, I want them to be as optimistic as I see people in China be. But there is a kind of spiritual, I think, deflation right now.
It seems like Kanye's whole theory of the great unity, basically, as you said, modern globalization, is undermined because he advocates Chinese, that what he says that we have a problem with patriotism. Yet you also advocate that we learn Chinese classes in order to understand the culture better. So is there a difference between globalization and conforming to Chinese ideals?
Okay, that's a really good question. So here's my answer to that. Kanye West is doing something I think we all do. That is, we all fall into the trap of imposing us on everyone else. I think it's somehow inevitable, right? So when Kanye West is saying we need a global culture, a global society without boundaries, without nationalism, without patriotism, yet when that global unity is created, in the end it should look an awful lot like China. No, he's wrong, right? I mean, clearly. But in some sense, what a lot of intellectuals are saying today, that that's just what we do. I mean, when I ask my mom, what should the world look like, it sounds an awful lot like corn dogs and apple pie, like the whole world. So when she defines what things should be, it's very American. And I think that intellectuals today are sort of seeing through that. And that's what I mean by the Chinese government, in some sense, is happy to reclaim its Chinese-ness, but at the same time, is really, I think, more and more accepting that there is a cultural diversity in the world. There's a way to have a unity without having a cultural homogeny. So I think people know that. But that doesn't mean that it's just not human nature to sort of valorize our own cultural identity.
You can get time for one more question. One over here.
Well, you can see that I have lived quite many years, half a century or something, but way back they used to say that the Chinese would kill girl babies. Is that a horrible rumor? Yes.
Well, that's a complicated... No, I mean, it's not a rumor, actually. I mean, China never has... Well, yes and no. It's not a cultural habit in the past to kill girl babies. This is a whole new lecture. This is a great lecture talk for the future. But there has been a habit in China traditionally to leave infant girls sort of on the street and entrust them to fate if you couldn't afford to raise them, or in the worst case scenario, you just wanted a boy and you didn't want a girl. So there's seriously a preference for boys in China, absolutely, to this day. In fact, in the year of the dragon, you'll have more babies than ever, and they'll mostly be boys because they'll abortively regulate what the gender of the child is. So that's a that is a habit in China. And most orphanages today are filled with girls. And I hate to end on this really sad note, but yes, that is a sad reality in China today. It's a good question, and here's my response. Let's pray for them. That's my response to that. I don't want to say, you know, it's not fair, by the way, to say that's just like all Chinese people are killing their daughters. That's absolutely not true. But that has been one aspect of Chinese culture. We've had our own. We'll bring the American historians up to talk about what our failings. But maybe just one, because I know... Okay. Oh, thank you.
I just thought you ought to know that Mandarin is taught at St. George's. You can start it in kindergarten and learn Mandarin all the way through.
Yeah, I think
so
I met
right
the teacher.
So right here in Spokane.
That's right. Awesome. That's amazing. That's wonderful. Let's try to get all of our high schools to do that.
Great. On a happy note, then, we will end. Let's all thank Dr. Clark for coming tonight. Thank you again for attending the Great Decisions Lecture Series. We hope to see you next year. Dr. Clark will be up here if you want to ask questions individually.